Hi, I'm Denise Howell, and you're about to join us for This Week in Law. My co-host Mike Keyes is here today, along with our guest, Tiffany Lee. We'll discuss whether stream rippers are okay, who owns the copyright in CGI characters, can a draft text message constitute a will, Microsoft goes to Ireland and the Supreme Court, is Amazon Key a little creepy? We'll discuss all these and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 405, recorded October 27th, 2017. Partying with the Big Hairy Guy. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Welcome back to the show if you're a regular listener or viewer, or welcome to the show if this is your first time joining us. If it is your first time joining us, I have some good news. Here on the day after the season premiere of Stranger Things, it's appropriate enough that we're celebrating the show's 11th anniversary. The show turned 11 last Sunday. Our first episode was October 22nd, 2016. So happy birthday to TWiL, and thank you for joining us this week on This Week in Law. We've got a great rundown of stuff to discuss today, and two wonderful people are joining me today. My co-host Mike Keyes is here. Hi, Mike. Great to see you.
Hi, Denise. Great to be back.
Good, good. We're glad we had a little pre-show moment where we feared you had the flu, but actually it's Matt who has the flu today. Sorry, Matt. We wish you well. You got to connect with Matt in, what is the name of the town that Notre Dame is in? I'm blanking.
Yeah, it's South Bend. Yes, we were able to connect for the big Notre Dame-USC football game last weekend. Couldn't connect during the game, but we were able to connect the next day, and it was a lot of fun to see Matt.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad you guys got to meet in the real world. Someone we haven't yet met in the real world, at least I haven't, but one of our co-hosts has Emery Roan and Tiffany were recently on a panel together. Tiffany's been on the show before. Tiffany Lee, great to have you back again, Tiffany.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Denise.
If you don't remember Tiffany's last appearance on the show, let me bring you up to speed as to who she is. She's an attorney and resident fellow at Yale's Information Society Project. She also heads the Wikimedia Yale Law Initiative on Intermediaries and Information. She's a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, which is how she and Emery have connected, and has her mind on many, many issues around intellectual property law, artificial intelligence, et cetera, concerning the web. So it's great to have you back on the show, Tiffany.
Thanks again. Love to be back.
Thanks again.
Great experience.
Let's start out with something interesting in the realm of the social web. I think the reason I wanted to begin the show with this topic, number one, is because Tiffany is someone who does a lot with, as I mentioned, intermediaries and information. And that is what Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is all about. If you joined us for our last episode of This Week in Law, you experienced a never not awesome appearance of Professor Eric Goldman on the show. And Professor Goldman pays a lot of attention to Section 230. So it's no surprise that he and others have noticed that there's an interesting Section 230 argument being made in a lawsuit involving the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. It is called Cockrum versus Donald J. Trump for President. And in it, the Trump campaign is the defendant, and they're alleged to have colluded with WikiLeaks and the Russians to disclose the plaintiff's private information. The plaintiff in the case, Cockrum, was among those who had information when the Democratic National Committee's emails were made public on WikiLeaks. So there at the beginning stages of this lawsuit, and they're litigating something called a motion to dismiss that can toss out the lawsuit before it has the chance to go very far, very early on in the proceedings. And it is the Trump campaign that has brought the motion to dismiss and says, among other things, they have made an argument under Section 230, claiming that WikiLeaks here is entitled to the immunity that would apply to, you know, you're used to hearing us talk about Section 230 on this show in the context of websites like, Google, YouTube, anybody, Facebook, anybody who's hosting third-party content that they have not created themselves. It enables them to do that without having to face liability every time one of those third parties does something wrong. And there are exceptions to Section 230, which we talked a lot about last week. But it's pretty interesting to see it applied here in the context of WikiLeaks. And Tiffany, I'm curious as to what you think about this argument.
Sure. So I don't really buy this argument. I think that if we accept the idea of WikiLeaks as intermediary, then we basically accept the idea of any newspaper or any publisher of facts or opinions as an intermediary. And I think the key difference here between WikiLeaks and, say, Wikipedia or Facebook or Google is that WikiLeaks doesn't act as a neutral source. So this is not something that, you know, is definitely 100% black and white. I know that different people, for example, Professor Eric Goldman, who was on your show last week, he wrote a blog post where he argues that it's possible that WikiLeaks could be considered an intermediary in the sense of Section 230. But in my opinion, I don't think WikiLeaks quite meets that standard. And I think what's more interesting is that this is an odd way to use Section 230 in general as a defense. It's very politicized, obviously. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with this because that's now such a political move.
Right. Mike, do you have any thoughts on this?
WikiLeaks is fantastic. I love it. I did read Professor Goldman's article. I think it's interesting. It looks like it's kind of an open question, but I agree with Tiffany. It seems like given what WikiLeaks is and what it purports to do, it seems like maybe it's a little bit outside of the bounds of Section 230, but it's going to be interesting to see how the court decides this motion to dismiss.
Yeah, WikiLeaks is an interesting and kind of unique creature in the world of online information sources. As Tiffany points out, it's not a place where, as long as you're complying with their terms of service and community guidelines, you can publicize anything via the site. They certainly exercise a lot of editorial control, if not complete editorial control, as to what they are making available. So it does seem like that's a distinguishing factor from a lot of the other sites that enjoy more solidly, or we would consider as a more classic example of a site that enjoys Section 230 immunity. But at the same time, you know, WikiLeaks, as you brought up, Tiffany, doesn't publish everything that people put on the site either. So it's I think it's going to be an interesting thing to watch play out. Any final thoughts on it, Tiffany?
I think it's interesting, and I don't want to belabor the point, but the political status of this particular interpretation of 230 is, I think, something that we should really look into. From the policy standpoint, I know that there have been lively discussions on Twitter, and a few people have mentioned just the fact that linking 230 to a controversial group like WikiLeaks may actually have some sort of impact on how Section 230 is seen, you know, not just in D.C., but nationwide. So there is always that sort of possibility that just having that link to a political group could make Section 230 or its chances, you know, could put them slightly more in danger.
Now, that's something I hadn't thought about yet. So Section 230 is already under fire, as we discussed last week, either because people think that it affords too much immunity and that sites should be more responsible, or more specifically, in the proposed SESTA legislation that's aiming to curb sex trafficking, but in the meantime is sweeping up how Section 230 operates and how it would afford protections to sites. So yeah, that's an excellent point that if WikiLeaks, which tends to be viewed as this sort of not unbiased source of information and perhaps not entirely above board in its practices, if it gets associated with a law that has been on the books forever and is now becoming controversial, it could endanger that law. And so people should watch this for that reason as well.
Definitely. And that's not a point that, you know, honestly, I didn't think of that first. I think that was either Daphne Keller or Anne-Marie Bridey who mentioned that first. Mm-hmm. And when I mentioned a lively Twitter debate, I mean, we've had a Twitter thread of about 100 replies. Julian Assange has also replied into the thread defending Section 230 and WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely not just a legal issue now. It's a political issue, which, of course, for the lawyers, though, becomes a problem. So I'm interested to see what happens. Like you mentioned, SESTA's on the table right now. 230 is already a little bit in, you know, dangerous waters. So we'll see. We'll see how this develops.
All right. We'll continue watching and see what the judge makes of the Trump campaign's motion to dismiss and this argument under Section 230. The other thing we have under our social web topic for the day for today, Tiffany, is one of the articles that has to do with how Facebook regulates its postings. And Monica Bickert, who recently spoke at both Yale and Harvard, I believe you're at Yale. So I wanted to just get your take. We discussed last week how Professor Goldman is planning for, I believe it's next February, what should be a great conference on content moderation at scale, how you navigate these Section 230 waters and maintain your protection, your safe harbors under that provision of law, and yet also have a site where, to the greatest extent possible, people are being civil to one another, or not defaming each other, or not otherwise engaging in conduct that is objectionable to the community and the site owner. So I wondered if you could tell us, did you get the chance to see Monica Bickert when she spoke?
I did. So when she spoke at Yale, I was in attendance. And mm-hmm. she made some excellent points. I think obviously Monica is someone who is so experienced on this issue. Really, anything she says is kind of a gem of practical wisdom, right? And if you think about content moderation, obviously Facebook is one of the biggest players in this field. And I think something really interesting that she mentioned was how much Facebook is taking responsibility right now, or at least trying to. But it does run into the same problem that really any international technology company has. And the internet has no borders, so every tech company is global. And the main issue, I think, is that when you have to comply with the laws of every nation, it's almost impossible to have a universal standard. So in terms of company policies and content moderation, it's very difficult to say that you have, you know, this one policy, because that one policy would ideally be able to comply with US law, Spain's law, France, Germany, China, Russia, etc. So I think that's a key difficulty, this international component, that it is something I think a lot of US scholars and practitioners don't think about as much. It's hard. It's a difficult job for Facebook and all of those intermediaries.
Yeah, I'm sure she will be in attendance at that conference next February. I don't know if I bothered to mention that Monica Bickert is the head of global policy management at Facebook. So someone who thinks a lot about these issues and who needs to navigate them at enormous scale. Mike, any thoughts?
Nothing further from my perspective.
All right. I think we're ready to move on to some interesting copyright stories. This one may not be on the radar, on your radar, if you're someone who follows copyright stories, or it may, but it's like a little sleeper of an issue that could turn into a big thing, I think. It was written up by Eric Gardner at The Hollywood Reporter Esquire, his wonderful blog there, and it has to do with CG characters in big films, or in little films for that matter. The issue here that's being litigated is between a software company that made a CG platform. It's called Reardon LLC. And they developed some software called Mova, which I guess is very popular in Hollywood. It captures facial expressions. It creates characters that don't look like the actual actors that are portraying them, a very photorealistic representation. If you think about various characters that you've seen in Marvel movies, you'll probably know exactly what I'm talking about. And what happened is Reardon, the founder of Mova, this software that creates these characters, had his intellectual property stolen, he says, by a former colleague. It wound up in the hands of a Chinese firm, which then sold it to big studios like Disney, Fox, and Paramount, who have been using it. And so Reardon is coming after these studios and alleging that these photorealistic characters created using Mova do not belong to the studios themselves, that they are a creation of the software. They would not exist but for the software. The term that is being used in the litigation, because it's something that was used in another case and seems to be the controlling legal principle here, or the evidentiary principle that will control how the law is applied, is that the MOVA program does the lion's share of the operations required to create these characters. And so what's being argued here, and again, we're at a fairly early stage of the litigation where we're having a court decide whether or not the case can go forward. What Mova and Reardon say is that these characters are infringing because he created this software that created them. So you can imagine how this becomes rapidly, if a court buys this, and ultimately this is litigated to a conclusion in Reardon and Mova's favor, that things that you've created with software may not actually be your own. You know, think about creating a Word document or a photograph using Photoshop, or perhaps a photograph using an app like Prisma that makes all the decisions for the enhancements it's going to make to your photograph and creates, you know, what becomes a work of art that never would have come out of your own photographic efforts. It does the lion's share of the work, in other words. So I think this is a really interesting case. There are some fascinating arguments being asserted as to who owns what and why. So, Mike, I toss it to you. What do you think of all this?
Oh, I think this is a very significant case, potentially. I think the arguments are very creative. Steve Berman is the lead counsel for the plaintiff. He's he tends to be a class action lawyer based here in Seattle. He's had a lot of class action litigations. So this is a potential game changer if the plaintiff could prevail, because it would obviously plow new ground here and set a brand new precedent. I think that all said, I think it's a difficult argument to make. I think that the weight of the authority would probably go against the plaintiff's argument here. But I must admit, I think it's a very intriguing, interesting possibility here, or an interesting argument that they're putting forth.
Yeah, they have a case that they're relying on. It looks like it's a trial court case. It doesn't look like, you know, when federal trial courts resolve disputes, they issue their own opinions. And they're sort of an interesting beast. They don't have the same weight, particularly outside their own jurisdictions, as a federal appellate court or certainly a Supreme Court decision would have. But they are citable. And that's what we're looking at here. It's a 2001 case out of the Southern District of New York that involved some software that looked for hidden messages in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible. A book was published that could not have been published without use of the software. It was called the Bible Code. And the creator of the software sued successfully. Under this lion's share argument that we've been discussing. So that's the case they're relying on. Again, it's a federal trial court case from a district across the country from where this is pending. So I don't know how much weight it will carry, but it is out there. It's, again, just kind of a fascinating thing to consider. And I agree with you, Mike, that should Reardon get traction with this, not only will it be very disruptive to Hollywood, but I think, you know, it starts to reach into how people do business with or use, even in their personal creative lives, all mm-hmm. kinds of software. Tiffany, any thoughts?
Sure. So I honestly don't really see the argument here. And it's mm-hmm. maybe telling to note that they had to reach into a random trial court case that wasn't even in their district. Because I think the weight of most copyright precedent goes against them. I know that the article that you mentioned and link cites Burrough-Giles, which obviously talks about the camera as a tool for artistic expression. Mm-hmm. Does not lend itself towards giving the software owner rights for things created from the software. I think what's missing there is just that idea of a creative spark. Right, there was creative intent by the author. Even when running the program, if you decide to run the program to, for example, create a walking, talking raccoon character from some movie, that sort of creative intent is authorial intent. And I think that's what copyright law at the end of the day is trying to protect. So most precedent, I don't think, is in their favor, but it's interesting. It's interesting to see where it goes. Talks, I think, a lot about what we're looking at right now, not just with software, but with the potential of AI creating works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that field is, you know, even more far-fetched than this is.
Right. Or you know, at least on somewhere on the same continuum. That's a topic we've brought up a lot on the show, you know, in the context of the monkey selfie case that was recently settled. You know, is AI next? And what constitutes a degree of creativity and autonomy that can have ownership rights. Certainly a non-AI software program, I don't think we have trouble applying a legal analysis to, but you start to throw independently thinking AI into the mix. And, it, you know, one of the things that we've discussed before on the show is that other countries have actually confronted this issue more head on than the U.S. has. The U.K. actually has some principles that grant copyright to. I think this case might be Reardon might have a better chance in the U.K. under their analysis that if software has created something, the creator of the software owns the creation. Do you think that it might be different in the UK than here, Tiffany?
I think the UK is a unique case because, like you mentioned, They're unique in having anything on the books about AI and copyright. But I think that generally, I've done some research in this area, and I think most IP scholars are sort of in the mindset that anything created by an AI, at least as we understand AI right now, should not be owned by the AI, because we don't have sentient AI that can think for itself. And even if we did, there's no way to give them incentives, right? The AI does not care about, you know, 70 years plus life. The AI doesn't care about economic incentives and so on. I think that right now, I wouldn't say it looks like the trend in IP scholarship regarding AI creation is lending itself towards a more of a work for hire model. So, you know, kind of making the AI somewhat analogous to an employee. In that sense, if you are the person who runs this AI, you are employing the AI by giving it instructions for what to create or what kind of thing to create. And thus you, the person, not the AI, should reap whatever benefits there are of the copyright. At least that's what the scholarship right now currently is leaning toward.
Mike, do you think we'll start to see this be dealt with contractually when programs like this are sold for use?
Well, it could be. You mean that the AI or the computer program that is creating this, there will be some sort of terms of use or terms of service that govern who owns the copyright to the output?
Right. Nobody wants to wind up in a dispute over that.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, I could see that. Short of this issue being taken up by the courts or Congress amending the statute to make it clear who owns the content in this context, I think we definitely could see more contractual arrangements between the parties. You know, I agree with Tiffany. I think this is ultimately a tough argument to make based on where the law is today. But I can see the argument that if what the plaintiff is saying here, that look, we've created or we've provided the vehicle that actually develops the content and that output is ours, it doesn't seem all that far-fetched to me that there's a legitimate infringement claim there. The problem is I just don't think the law has caught up with that concept yet, although in theory I think it could get there, and who knows, this might be the case. I will say that on the procedural context here is maybe a little bit tough for the defendants, because they've moved to dismiss, you know, under Rule 12B, and they're saying there's just no set of facts. And there is a Ninth Circuit case that touched on this a while back in the context, I think it was like CAD drawings or something. I think this argument was made. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit said, well, there's not sufficient facts to show that the output is independently copyrightable. In other words, that the output created an independently copyrightable work. And therefore, in that case, the plaintiff didn't prevail. But it may be a little too early on in the proceeding for the court to pull the trigger on this argument. This case may proceed and go through discovery, and we may wind up at the summary judgment stage.
Right. Another one that's at the very early stages of litigation that's going to be interesting to watch as it unfolds. And a good segue into talking about the copyrightability of characters, I think, because another of our stories for this week involves just that. Disney has decided to come at a company who provides, it's called Characters for Hire LLC. And it provides well-known characters in costume to appear at events, et cetera, for pay. Disney has come after them, alleging that they are a knockoff business built on the infringement of the plaintiff's highly valuable intellectual property rights. Various characters that Characters for Hire uses are Darth Vader, Iron Man, Elsa and Anna from Frozen, Aurora from Sleeping Beauty, etc. And so we're going to see these parties duke it out as well over whether this company's business can proceed in the way that it has conducted itself in the past. They are at the summary judgment phase of their litigation. And some interesting arguments are being asserted by Characters for Hire. first of all, claiming that there's no getting really technical about the copyright registrations themselves, and saying that nothing that Characters for Hire does copies, reproduces, distributes, or displays any of the two-dimensional artwork that is the subject of those copyright registrations. We've seen other cases. We've talked about other cases on the show where characters have been subject to copyright. So I don't know how far they're going to get there. But they also raise the, I think, more valid point that various of Disney's characters, perhaps not Darth Vader, but sundry others such as Loki and Thor and Cinderella, Snow White, other fairy tale characters, exist in a world beyond Disney, exist in the world of mythology and fairy tale, et cetera, and would be in the public domain. And then they make an interesting trademark argument too, Mike, that basically argues that even if they're using something that would be subject to trademark law protection, they are doing so in a descriptive way. So why don't we start there, since that's your specialty, Mike, and see what you make of that argument.
Yeah, so as I understand it, they're saying that they've changed their names. Like, they're no longer using Star Wars, they're now using Star Battle. Is that the line that you're talking about, some of these other changes?
Yes. Yes, yeah. or you know, right. Here's what they say. Each of the trademarks, there's no likelihood of confusion, because when you see Darth Vader show up at a Characters for Hire event, you're not thinking the Disney sent that character. So they make that argument.
Right.
Yeah, and go from there.
I don't think much of that argument.
Yeah.
I think that look, whether you think it's Disney that sent it or some other company, you associate, or this is the argument, and I think it's a pretty good one. Mm-hmm. You would associate that character with a particular source, i.e. the Star Wars franchise or the Disney franchise, or you may not know exactly who sent this character, but you definitely associate it with a particular source. So I don't buy that argument much. The other argument that they're making is that, well, we changed the name. We're no longer using Darth Vader. We now use Dark Lord.
Right.
Or, Chewbacca is now called the Big Hairy Guy. So, yeah, maybe some of these changes in terms of the names get them out of hot water when it comes to trademark. But you still got the underlying copyright issue, which is you're copying the character itself. And a lot of these characters are very well known, very famous, very distinctive. And so they probably have some pretty good arguments that these characters are themselves independently copyrightable. But there is an interesting argument here about, well, what exactly was copied? Because a lot of Disney characters do come from pre-existing public domain material. And mm-hmm. So it sounds like the defendants are saying, well, we didn't copy the Star Wars character per se. What we were really copying is stuff that was in the public domain. Now, probably what happened here is that there's copying of both. There's probably copying of the public domain materials, but also the elements that make up these characters that Disney created or some of these other content owners created. So I don't know. This seems like probably a tough case for the defendants to win.
Right. The other really interesting part of the arguments being made here on the trademark front, your brain probably went right to Times Square when you started hearing about this case, because that's where you would expect to see characters in costume walking around and possibly taking photographs with you for cash. But some of the precedent on this involves Times Square's The Naked Cowboy. And he actually once tried to sue CBS for trademark violations. And argued that he had fair use to it was CBS that argued they had fair use use that character. And that is why the Naked Cowboy's claim did not go forward, that it was descriptive enough there. It was a naked cowboy, I guess, rather than the naked cowboy that was used in the soap opera The Bold and the Beautiful. The court there held that it was a descriptive use of the mark, and thus fair use. So it could be that if Characters for Hire prevails, it might do so based at least in part on the naked cowboy argument. Tiffany, what do you think about this?
Interesting. I can't say I think of that when I walk through Times Square. But, you know, actually, I'm not sure if either of you watch the shows Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt or Arrested Development, because both of those shows recently have had storylines that talk specifically about these costume characters and copyright infringement. So this is, you know, in the public sphere right now, I guess non-lawyers care about this. The naked cowboy, or any naked cowboy of non, you know, trademark way, may care about this. I think that it's interesting, especially when you talk about those sort of classic characters from fables, right? I mean, I don't see that there's really a good argument for owning the IP for Cinderella, except for the specific form of Cinderella that Disney has created. And in that sense, I think I agree with Mike, though. There isn't much law that would help the defendants there when it's a very specific depiction of Cinderella that they're using.
Right, and costuming, et cetera, that might identify her in the Disney context as opposed to otherwise. I think we have our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, and it's going to be A, not the, but A, naked cowboy. Write that down if you are interested in receiving professional credit in your field, whether it be the law or some other field, for listening to or watching the show. If you are a lawyer in the United States, you can head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and we've got a chart that will hopefully give you some guidance on how you can apply in your jurisdiction to perhaps be eligible for credit. So we put these phrases into the show in case you need to verify that you actually watched or listened. And we'll put another one in. Oh, great video, Victor. Before the end of the show. So that hopefully you can accomplish your professional credit goals along with playing along with us. Another interesting copyright development that caught my eye this week is an argument having to do with stream ripping websites and EFF coming to their defense. Now, years and years ago, the RIAA came after companies that used to allow you to separate movie content or other video content from an encrypted DVD that would allow you to rip contents from DVDs that were not as easy to rip from CDs and that were protected by copy protection. This is a slightly different and more modern twist on that same theme. And that is because stream rippers have been under fire by the RIAA because there is so much musical content now available on video sharing sites such as YouTube, and various stream ripping sites allow you to separate out the audio track and do what you will with it. EFF is raising some similar arguments, although I don't know whether the DMCA would be implicated here. It doesn't really feel like encryption is being circumvented here by isolating the audio track from a video that's available. It seems like a different animal than the prior context I was mentioning. But in any event, some of the similar defenses for the practice are being advanced by the EFF, such as that not every time you extract audio from a video would constitute an infringement. There are plenty of episodes where that could be fair use. There is plenty of material out there where it would not be infringement to reuse the original material, whether it's licensed or public domain or what have you. So it's just an interesting little wrinkle that the EFF is paying attention to. and looking out for the legality or potential illegality of stream ripping software. They have submitted comments to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative this month on this topic. Tiffany, any thoughts?
I think this is interesting. I'm not completely sure that this is different than precedent that we already have about, as you mentioned, streaming DVDs or ripping from DVDs. It looks like EFF is arguing that the specific companies that allow for taking the audio data are not performing an illegal service, because while they may be facilitating possible infringement, they themselves are not infringing on copyright. Mm-hmm. And that's possible. They're acting sort of as an intermediary, not an information intermediary in the terms of, you know, Section 230, but a middleman between the person who may be infringing or who may be creating fair use transformative music and the copyright holder. It's an interesting argument, but I'm still not sure that that beats the earlier precedent, again, regarding DVDs. So I'm interested in seeing what the two of you think about that.
Yeah, Mike, what do you think? Do we have, are there DMCA ramifications here, do you think?
Well, I don't know that there's DMCA ramifications for the exact reason that you mentioned. It doesn't appear as though they're getting around any sort of, they're not circumventing an access control. If they are, then yes, there's absolutely DMCA problems associated with this. Right. But to the extent they're just able to take the stream and separate it somehow from the video without violating access controls, they should be okay under the DMCA. I am skeptical of this argument, though. You know, when I read the EFF's comments, it reminded me of the arguments that Grokster was making, that, look, our service, people are using it to exchange Shakespeare and all sorts of other works in the public domain. So I don't know. Maybe people are using this to stream the audio version of Hamlet on YouTube from the video a lot. Who knows? But yeah,
that's what I'm using it for.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, you know, maybe there's a bunch of Denise Howells out there that are just using it to, you know, separate the audio and video files on Shakespeare.
Right. And you're exactly right that it's reminding me of the arguments advanced in the Napster and Grokster litigation, and particularly the U.S. Supreme Court precedent of Sony versus Universal, where involving the Sony Betamax, and where it was found to have substantial non-infringing uses and therefore okay and not copyright infringement to make tapes of broadcast television, and other programming. So there's that concept. The other thing that just sort of leaps out at me as we're having this discussion is, you know, how prevalent really are these things? Are in a world where, you know, you can, we've pretty much solved the music piracy issue at this point, and there are so many ways to have all you can eat music for reasonable or fairly reasonable prices. Is stream ripping really something that people are taking the time to engage in? I guess so, because the RIAA is concerned about it. Anecdotally, Tiffany, what do you think? Do you think this is a big problem or something that the RIAA just wants to take a stand on?
Well, I have no statistical knowledge of how many people are using stream rippers.
Yeah.
I do know that, you know, for myself, like you mentioned, I use some of those easy music methods that we have available. So I have a Spotify account. I have an infinite number of songs I can listen to at any time. They can be on my phone, on my computer. Honestly, it's really not worth the time for me to even look into downloading an MP3 stream ripper. But I'm sure people still do. So, you know how music rights holders are in that industry. I'm not surprised that this is becoming an issue.
Uh-huh. Yeah, interesting. Actually, folks in chat are chiming in saying, no, it's more common than you think. So it's more common than I think, apparently. Mm. Yeah. All right. Then let us move on and talk about some privacy stories. Interesting grant of cert by the United States Supreme Court in a case that we've discussed on the show before, the case that involves Microsoft and its battle with the Justice Department as to information that it needs or does not need to supply that is housed overseas, here specifically in Ireland. It was required as part of a criminal investigation to turn over user information. I think it was a drug crime investigation that's the underlying driver of all of this. And what Microsoft did was say, we're going to give you access to everything that is stored in the U.S., but not in Ireland. So they've been litigating this for some time, and the Second Circuit actually went to an en banc panel, which split. That means not just the regular panel of three judges that would have heard the case, but a larger panel of the court. And they evenly split over what Microsoft should be required to do here. So the Supreme Court is going to jump in at some point during this term and give us its take as to whether a U.S. company can evade being able to respond to law enforcement requests by storing material outside of the U.S. So that will be an interesting Supreme Court case to watch for this term. The historical cell site data case will also be one to watch, also having to do with what law enforcement is entitled to request when it comes to digital data. So, Tiffany, do you have any thoughts on this grant of cert by the Supreme Court?
I have many thoughts. And I think that, you know, anyone working in this field will have many thoughts about this. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, the main issue to look at is jurisdiction, right? Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned before, the internet has no borders. And that creates a lot of interesting legal issues because these tech companies still are headquartered in countries. They have branches that are located physically in countries. For example, like Microsoft's data center is located in Ireland, while Microsoft's headquarters are obviously in the US. And I think these jurisdictional issues are broader than just this specific case, although this specific case is definitely going to create some interesting precedent. I think generally we're running into these issues, not just with Microsoft Ireland, but with most cases, I think, are actually sort of the opposite of this, where a foreign country or a foreign company tries to make an argument that a U.S. company ought to comply with, you know, some law in another another nation state because of its presence in that nation. So this jurisdictional issue generally, I think, is going to be very important. And Microsoft Ireland specifically is really interesting to me because, again, it's sort of the opposite of what we usually see in these jurisdictional breakdown cases. I have no idea how the Supreme Court will rule, but I'm definitely watching this and I will love to see what happens.
Yeah, the Justice Department's argument is that it makes no difference from Microsoft's standpoint to respond to this request, that there should be no reason why it can sit in its headquarters in Redmond and deliver one set of data under its control, but not the other. It's not like Microsoft has to go to Dublin to access the files there. But as you point out, Tiffany, there we do have borders and arrangements with foreign countries. And one of the arguments that Microsoft advances is, okay, if you're going to go down this road where we are forced to turn over our data that we happen to store in a data center in Ireland, then think about what the converse of that is. Think of all of the data stored in the U.S. that we're going to have to make available to foreign governments if this is the stance that we take. Mike, does that persuade you at all?
I
I thought it was very persuasive. Mm-hmm. On the surface, when I look at this case, I think, well, this seems to be almost kind of a no-brainer in favor of the government because, you know, if you got a subpoena and you have access to the data, it's in your custody and control, at least in a civil context, I think there's going to be a very compelling argument that you have to turn that over. Now, there may be some unique criminal aspects to this case or different procedural aspects that counsel in favor of a different result. But on the surface, it seems to me to be a fairly straightforward case in one sense. But I thought the arguments that Microsoft's GC, Brad Smith, was advancing do raise some very interesting policy considerations because, you know, if a foreign country is able to subpoena or a foreign governmental authority in some other country is able to subpoena records here in the U.S., God knows what could happen to those records once they're disclosed. So I think that the argument makes a lot of sense, and I certainly found it persuasive.
Well, we'll see what the Supreme Court thinks about it all. I'm sure we'll see many, many arguments both from the parties in the case and from various friends of the court who realize that this is an important issue and that can weigh in on areas that the parties might not. So it's going to be interesting to follow this one through the Supreme Court, and we will be sure and do that for you, let you know what's going on in this case as it unfolds. In the meantime, though, I wanted to, since we have Tiffany on the show today, Tiffany, you co-authored an article this last summer having to do with AI and the right to be forgotten, not two concepts that I'd ever put together before. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that, how they collide.
Sure. So I co-authored this paper with Edward Foch Villaronga and Peter Kaisberg. And it's an interesting approach, first of all, to co-authoring a paper when you have three different authors from very different disciplines. So Edward is an attorney who had most of his training in the EU. Peter is a researcher with a technical background. And I'm, of course, a US-trained attorney. So while we all have perspectives on this, I think that this sort of interdisciplinary work, first of all, was really fascinating for me. And I think really interesting in terms of specifically discussing the technical impacts of these laws. So our paper is called Humans Forget, Machines Remember, Artificial Intelligence and the Right to be Forgotten. And this is something, this is a sort of problem that I've been thinking about for a long time. I can give you a brief overview. So the right to be forgotten is a specific right that allows for EU residents to ask websites or organizations, like, for example, Google, to delete information, for example, search results, that may pertain to their own personal information. So in the most likely scenario, if you are someone who has committed a crime and you ask Google to remove your search results, technically under the right to be forgotten, you should have that right. You should have the right to make your anything about yourself be forgotten. So this is an interesting right, first of all, that we don't really talk about in the United States because we have almost the opposite point of view, right? We think that all speech is sacred and we should have everything out there almost as much as possible. But the right to be forgotten is definitely entrenched in EU privacy law. The issue that we point out in our paper, though, is that it doesn't really make sense in context of big data, artificial intelligence, or machine learning. And you can stop me if this is getting too long, but the crux of the problem is that when you need to forget something, a machine doesn't forget the same way that a human forgets. When you forget something, it's not in your memory anymore. Easy. If you ask an artificial intelligence system or a machine learning algorithm to forget a piece of data that's been already added into the system, either in training data or elsewhere, that is very complicated. And we have a few different explanations of why that's particularly complicated. First of all, in the law, there's no definition of what it means to delete. So we don't know if we can comply simply by overwriting whatever file that was there, by simply making a null value, by actually somehow excising it from whatever database we have, or so on. That's not clear in the law. It's difficult for people to comply with it. In a general sense, it's also difficult because, you know, an AI is built on using training data to improve its model continuously. So even if you do delete the data from an AI system, that model has still been trained on the data that you input.
Got it. So this seems fascinating. Can you give us any takeaway or conclusion that you haven't mentioned already?
Sure. So I think that the most interesting example for me goes back to the idea of someone wanting to erase records of something that they've done. Mm-hmm. So if you commit a crime and you try to get all of those news articles about you deleted, sure, you can do that. But if you train an AI system to determine who is more likely to be a criminal based on crimes already committed by people, that AI system already has in its, you know, so-called memory, the memory of your particular crime. So even if your record is expunged, even if your crime result was overturned, the AI system is still slightly biased in favor of determining that people who are like you are more likely to be criminals. And this goes into the whole issue of AI and criminal justice, which is, you know, much broader than just AI and right to be forgotten. But that's, I think, the ultimate impact of this. It's really a huge host of issues that the law just is not ready to deal with yet.
So as far as the right to be forgotten goes, though, and the example that you just gave, if the AI had, as part of what it was trained on, the information that you mentioned, but it were anonymized, would that matter?
So I think that there are two ways to think about this. So if it was anonymized, then you at least don't have your personal information included in whatever reports may come out. And you do technically, you could say that technically the right to be forgotten was upheld in that case because no personal information was included. Mm-hmm. But I think the criminal justice aspect still plays a role because even if there's no personal information be included in, for example, the recommendation that the algorithm may make as to who might be a criminal, the algorithm itself might be slightly more biased, again, towards you just based on your information, not based on anything linking to your actual, you know, name or any PII.
Yep, absolutely. Mike, any thoughts?
So, Tiffany, I'm curious, are you and your colleagues, are you proposing legislation of some sort to deal with this? Or are you thinking about a possible legislation that would take this into account somehow, or...
Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, as I am not, I don't know if my co-authors are, but I think what we're really looking into right now is just generally the GDPR being, I don't want to say completely inapplicable, but not quite there. And it's worrying to me, and I think to my co-authors as well, that the GDPR is coming into effect very soon next year, is potentially reaching out to companies all over the world. Everyone will have to comply with this regulation, but we haven't actually figured out what this means. So there are issues involving the right to be forgotten and AI. Really, many aspects of the law in terms of machine learning and AI don't really make sense. There is guidance on things like automatic data processing, automatic decision making, but the law is behind what current technology is. And you can say that about most laws, right? Most of the time, law is catching up to tech. But it's concerning that a law that tries to regulate so much of tech, so broadly regulate tech, is so much, you know, behind what tech really is.
Got it. Thank you so much for your insights there, Tiffany. I think we're ready to move on to something that I've put under terms of service that doesn't fit perfectly there, and I'll tell you why in a sec. All right. The reason that I put this under terms of service is because it is a written instrument dictating somebody's intent, like a contract. But it's not a contract. It's deemed, I guess, by an Australian court to be a will. So a will is not quite the same thing as a contract, but still, you know, somewhat similar. It's your written specification of your intent, and it has consequences. So this was a really interesting little twist here, because the deceased 55-year-old man otherwise would have died without a will. And when that happens, much like in the U.S., there's a process that deals with the management of the estate, and it is automatically assigned to your next of kin. That would have been his wife in this case. However, on his phone, in a drafts folder, was found information on how to access this guy's bank account, and directions for what to do with his ashes, and also instructions concerning, let's see, I think it's his brother and nephew that were to have the house and do various things with the money that were not the wife, who would have received whatever he left behind had this not been discovered. So it's a weird little twist. I don't know if it would happen in the United States or not, that something in a draft folder that had never been communicated apparently would be deemed to be the last will and testament of someone who died. Here there was Australian law that allowed for special cases with less formal documentation to be the person's will, and that seems to be what they relied on. And certainly in the U.S., you know, if I remember back to my estates and trusts class in law school, you have informal wills that are enforced here too. I guess the twist here that caught my eye is the fact that it seems to have been, you know, not communicated. And again, you could have an informal will or a formal one that's not communicated here in the U.S., and it would still be enforceable. It's still the will. But draft folder on a phone, it just seemed like a unique situation to me. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me as a perfect like law school exam question or bar exam question here. Mm-hmm. I was kind of stunned to read this story. I mean, I know virtually nothing about wills, but this seems to be, the reasoning here is a bit precarious. I mean, one, how do we even know, how do you even authenticate that this individual drafted this? Mm-hmm. I mean, couldn't somebody else, one of these interested parties have grabbed the phone and doctored this up or changed it or drafted it? So that seems to be a pretty significant hurdle. And then two, who knows what state of mind this guy was in? Maybe he was super upset at night and decided to draft it, and then the next morning he thought better of it and never sent it. I mean, so it just seems to me to be ripe with all sorts of problems here. But great law school exam question, no doubt about it.
Yes, our public service for the week for our law professor listeners and viewers. Make a note of this one. Tiffany, any thoughts?
So I do have a thought. It's not completely related, but mm-hmm. I was thinking about what Mike just said. You can't tell, you know, if this was drafted by the right person, you can't tell a state of mind. I wasn't surprised actually when I read this, that a text message draft could be considered similar to, say, you know, a note that you hid in your desk drawer, claiming to be your will, right? That seems pretty similar to me. But that idea that you can't tell who authored the note is interesting. And that made me think, if in the future we do have, for example, better brain imaging technology, and if you can, you know, think your thoughts into a computer system, which, by the way, is technology that Facebook is actually looking at developing right now. If you have tech that can literally read your thoughts, I wonder if you could then create your will just by thinking what you want in your will and not by writing anything down, because this then would be able to be authenticated as your own intent. You would know state of mind. You would definitely know the author. And this might actually be a better form of a will than a written document. But that's going a little further than what the article is talking about.
So, absolutely. Yes, you're living in a future I have not yet contemplated, right. Tiffany.
And your will, I mean, would be subject part, to
right? Yeah.
Your will would be subject to change every few hours, depending on your state of mind, right?
Right. Who your favorite possible relative is, whether you're mad at your kid. Speaking of living in a future we've not yet contemplated, Mike, Tiffany and I were talking before the show, and we don't have anything in our discussion points about this, but we thought we might just riff for a moment on the sort of futuristic theme that we're on right now, thinking in the context of the sexual inequality kind of arguments that have been so in the news in the tech industry now for a while in Hollywood and are so prevalent, you know, in many, many industries. And the hashtag Me Too movement that has shed a light on how many people have been have faced these kinds of problems in their lives, far more, I think, than anyone imagined, far more than have gone to the police or a court to take possibly pursue remedies for what they've been subjected to. And we've had some interesting discussions on the show in the past about the beginnings, the inklings of technological solutions to these problems. We've had Michael Lysak on the show at least once, maybe twice, and he is the father of some apps that have tried to tackle issues like this. One is called We Consent. One is called the No App. There are a couple of more now in that app suite that he's created that seem designed for people to take a pause in their interpersonal relationships. And again, I don't think, and we discussed this at the time we had him on, that anybody thinks that you could form a contract, an enforceable contract under the law that shows your consent. But you can do something with his apps that shows evidence. So if there's some dispute down the road, you have something contemporaneous that happened alongside whatever event then became controversial, that you can point to and say, hey, you know what, we really took the time to actually document that we were engaging in this specific activity. And again, the problem with the consent app is a potential problem is I've consented to this, but maybe not to that. And, you know, how do you break that down? But also the No app is really interesting because it allows someone to make a record that they're not consenting to something. And then they've added to the suite with a really, I think, important app that allows people who have been subjected to potentially something awful, potentially something less awful on the spectrum, but still, you know, they want to make a record of what happened to them close to the time that it happened, and it gives you the ability to do that too. So that's one technological effort to sort of alter people's behavior to deal with this social ill. And the reason that it occurred to me is we've seen some success with that, with technology. If you look at the health world, you see Fitbits and other fitness tracking apps and activities being able to actually change the way that people behave. You see the insurance industry getting involved and saying, hey, you know, if you're a company that encourages your employees to monitor their health, thus keeping our costs down, we're going to keep your premiums down, that sort of an approach. So I'm wondering, I just wanted to sort of pick your two brains out of the blue sky. If you think, and particularly you, Tiffany, on the AI front, that technology might be able to assist this particular social ill that's been so in the news lately. We'll start with you, Tiffany. What do you think?
I think, you know, it's a little difficult to, at least for me, to think about an AI related solution because, you know, AI at the end of the day is just advanced statistics at this moment. So I'm not totally sure how we could use that in order to help navigate the issues of, you know, our social or of harassment or of, you know, equality in the workplace and so on. I'm not sure what we could do there. I am interested in just general tech solutions, but I think that this is such a broader societal issue that, You know, tech solutions may not be it. I think that we need definitely more education generally, more awareness. And I think just, you know, sometimes we don't need AI. We might just need empathy.
That's a wonderful phrase, turn of phrase there, Tiffany. I do appreciate that. I wonder, I guess the world that I'm sort of envisioning is a world of AI far beyond the one we live in now, where we're just advanced statistics, where we actually are dealing with something that can make good judgments and help its users make good judgments and you know, trigger. And maybe you wouldn't even need, you know, a fully sentient AI, maybe just something that had enough of a framework to know behavior that I'm monitoring right now, and of course it would have to monitor your behavior, is starting to cross a line and it lets you know. Do you think that could ever happen?
I think it could happen, but that just worries me a little bit more. We talked about AI and criminal justice already, and that scenario, as well as the scenario you just mentioned about AI monitoring behavior and suggesting good behaviors, I find that problematic, because what we have right now of our more advanced AI, when we take human behavior into account, pretty much any AI that we design or create or train is inherently biased. The algorithms that we create are biased, which leads the algorithms they create to be biased. The training data we give them is biased. The way we draw conclusions from the data is also biased. So I am concerned about the idea of using AI to determine what is, you know, healthy behavior in a workplace, for example, because we have these biases and we haven't really fixed them yet. But I could see a day when we have better AI, right? Maybe not perfect sentient AI, but AI. And it's possible that could then help us, you know, learn things about ourselves and maybe about how we interact with each other. But I do think that, now, even before we get there, we should try to fix things a little bit first.
Yep, that's a good point. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a pernicious problem, and I'm so glad to see that it's being addressed. I do think that technology plays a part. I mean, we saw, as you mentioned, Denise, the Me Too, the hashtag Me Too movement. I mean, my God, there was a lot of disclosures there. And I think, you know, the best way to combat this problem is to have full disclosure and have people that are brave enough to speak their minds and share their experiences. And, you know, we've just seen most recently in the last couple of days with Mark Halperin, all the information has come out about him, and no doubt this is just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, hopefully we can, as a society, eradicate this type of behavior, because it's just got to go. There's no place for it.
Right. And I guess by just sort of speculating about a world where behavior is monitored and suggested, I mean, that really feels more like science fiction than fact. Yeah. And it feels like dystopian science fiction, as Tiffany points out, a bit creepy. But again, I don't think it's entirely out of the range of possibility, because, you know, if you had asked me 10 or 15 years ago, do you think in 10 or 15 years people will be wandering around letting their location and their every activity be tracked to see if they're doing healthy things? I would have said, no, I think that'll creep people out. But, you know, that's the world we're living in today. And it's a world that's supported by businesses and insurance companies, you know, who have a vested financial interest in making sure that people behave in a certain way. So I would just toss out there that maybe that dystopian future isn't quite as unlikely as we may think today.
Thanks, Denise, for that.
Yeah,
optimistic outlook.
Yeah, but maybe it won't look as creepy when we're there. I mean, do health trackers creep you out as much as a behavior tracker would?
And that's a good point. I guess it's an escalating scale, right? Yeah. Like, we're okay with Fitbits, we're okay with Apple tracking your location, we're okay with checking in, monitoring your friends' lives on social media. So I guess the next step is allowing for AI to monitor us and our social behavior and determine our worldwide social norms.
Mm-hmm.
Lawn Dog in IRC is chiming in and saying the concept might be here earlier than you think. Toyota is working on sensors that detect emotion from the driver and makes the car react to those emotions like anger. So I haven't vetted that, but it seems like an interesting thing right in line with what we're talking about, having your car maybe take certain protective steps if it detects that you're driving recklessly because you're emotional. Mike, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to kind of riff on your point about I think we're getting more and more acculturated to technology being part of our everyday existence, our every second existence. I was thinking about a story. This is a true story. It's not all that significant, but I think it kind of proves the point that when I was a kid growing up, we had a large family. There were seven kids, and we had a couple of telephones in the house. And my mom always demanded that the telephones be turned off during dinner time because it was so disruptive. So it's kind of funny thinking about it today, you know, where we have telephones, all of our kids have telephones and are constantly on them, and not to mention all the other technological advances. So in 10, 15, 20 years from now, absolutely, I could see this being somewhat of a reality and it just being part of our normalized experiences as humans.
Yep. There you go. Your hopeful note for the day. I think we have our second MCLE passphrase for the show, and that is Big Brother AI. If you've written these down, we've now got both phrases in the show, and we hope they help you out. Let's move on to a trademark topic, something written by one of Mike's colleagues. We had a couple of cases at the top of the show we discussed that involved litigation at its earliest stages. This is one at one of the final stages, and thankfully it involves the movie Dirty Dancing and the trademark phrase, no one puts baby in a corner. Can you tell us what happened to your mic?
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty fun case. We've blogged about it a couple of times. So Lionsgate Entertainment owns, or maybe one of its affiliates, owns the copyright to Dirty Dancing, or at least some of the trademarks associated with that movie franchise, one of which is being Nobody Puts Baby in a Corner, and I think there's a couple of other ones. I think there's been some unregistered trademarks that have been used by this plaintiff, but it all relates to Dirty Dancing. And TD Ameritrade came out with this very clever, funny advertising campaign where it showed a silhouetted figure lifting a piggy bank above its head, much like the lift in Dirty Dancing between Patrick Swayze and Baby. and the ad itself said, nobody puts your old 401k in a corner. And there were some other references to Dirty Dancing in this advertising campaign. So Lionsgate sued for trademark infringement, and that case was dismissed. The court said there's no infringement here because this claim is preempted by the Copyright Act. This is an expressive work, and you can't bring a copyright claim based on a U.S. Supreme Court case called Daystar. So the parties went along, ultimately settled the case, and apparently as part of the settlement, Lionsgate wanted the court's motion to dismiss order vacated. And so they both went back to the district court. TD Ameritrade didn't object to the vacature of the opinion. They asked the court to vacate the motion to dismiss order. And the court said, no, I'm not going to do it. I decided the law correctly. And you're essentially asking me to vacate my decision that's been already issued. And I'm not going to do it. So the decision lives on, at least at this point.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed there. Any excuse to reference Dirty Dancing is more than welcome on This Week at Law at any time.
I should mention that it's not all that atypical for parties in litigation where one of them is dissatisfied with a court's ruling to seek to have that decision essentially wiped off the books. Sometimes courts go along with it, sometimes not. And this judge was not going to have any part of it. Nobody's going to put this court in a corner.
Very good. Isn't that essentially what we're seeing too, and could still happen or may have happened, and I missed it, in the PETA monkey selfie case. Didn't they want to go back and undo, yes, the trial court's decision there? So I think we're still waiting for the other shoe to drop on that one. If it has dropped, please let me know. I haven't actually affirmatively researched in the last week or so. Any thoughts, Tiffany?
I think that sums it up pretty well.
All right. Let's move on to a final story that involves or could potentially involve crimes and justice. I bring this up simply because I'm internally conflicted about Amazon Key, the service that was announced this week that involves a smart lock and a security camera and an app that would enable delivery people to open your front door and deposit packages inside instead of letting them pile up. I guess this must be a real problem for Amazon and its more avid customers, that things do tend to sort of pile up on your porch if you're a heavy Amazon user and are ripe just to be made off with if you're not otherwise surveilling your front porch area. So this addresses that problem, and hopefully from Amazon's standpoint enables them to sell more stuff and get more stuff in your home and more of your money in their bank account by safely getting it inside. But I stuck it in our rundown here today because I wonder just, you know, if the two of you look at this and have the same sort of, gee, that's wonderful and convenient and addresses the problem, but so much could go wrong kind of reaction that I'm having to it. Mike, what do you think?
I did think the same thing. I mean, I guess it's a neat service for those that are just Amazon Prime crazy and just can't get enough, and they have everything piled up at their front door. But yeah, I agree with you. It seems like this could be problematic, just letting somebody remote into your house. Although it does sound like there's some safeguards there associated with camera that you can actually view them as they're coming in and leaving the premises. So it sounds like they've thought it out pretty well, but I don't know. I mean, anytime you're providing access to somebody, a stranger no less, that seems to me to be problematic. I mean, right. For one, maybe this person has decided that, you know, you've got some nice things in your house. They're just going to go ahead and grab them and take off, and you know, you've got a problem there. So I don't know. It does seem potentially problematic.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that Amazon would have responses as to the vetting of the people allowed in and your control over who is allowed in. And they're not, you know, it's something they clearly have their eye on a larger prize. They want to partner with Merry Maids and allow your housekeepers access this way if you're the kind of person who is interested in that. Also in the Business Insider piece that we have in our discussion points, which you can access at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're in episode 405 this week. They link out to a Walmart program that would similarly allow people, you know, representatives, delivery people from Walmart to do in-home delivery that actually puts groceries in your refrigerator. So they're not just dropping the box on the inside of your house. Same with Merry Maids. They're coming all the way in and accessing every part of your house. But the Walmart folks are actually coming in and putting stuff in your fridge. Again, all of this is just testing. We're again looking into the future here of things that might be more widespread at some point. But clearly somebody will figure out a way to crack this home access when you're not there issue. And all of these companies are taking a crack at it now. So Tiffany, could AI help?
Well, as we discussed, I don't think AI is a solution for everything. I do think that this move by Amazon is really interesting. Not for the groceries. I don't really care about the groceries. I don't care about the packages. But what's interesting to me is how much they're integrating Amazon devices into your home. Mm-hmm. So they already have the Amazon Echo, and they have a slew of devices that are related that use the Alexa format. And now they have this new initiative to let you use your smart lock, use Amazon cameras, have Amazon delivery people in your home. If you move forward to the future, just the near future, you can imagine this in conjunction with, for example, the delivery drones Amazon's doing, and with self-driving cars, and with smaller robots in general. You can imagine a world in which you have your Amazon house with your Amazon locks that are automatically controlled or controllable by the Amazon delivery drone dropping off the Amazon delivery robot that directs the package directly into your home. And that's an ecosystem that I think isn't that far-fetched. And I think that this sort of, right now it's a human delivery system, and it seems odd because we have, you know, trust issues about letting random strangers into our homes. But that entire issue of trust is also one way that they could bring more robots into the process. I can definitely see Amazon or different companies saying, you know, do you really trust this random delivery person? Because if you don't, we have this handy robot, which you can track online and which probably will track you and which you can just use for any of your deliveries. I don't care about the groceries, but I think that's what's coming.
Right. And, you know, probably the same argument could be made for the ride sharing universe. Hey, if you don't like getting into a car with someone you're not familiar with, then our self-driving cars may be the way for you to go. And that may be the direction that we're headed in both of those arenas. Lawn Dog has some good comments in IRC. First is wondering why the heck their first step was actually letting people into your home. If really what they're about is getting your items safely delivered, maybe they'd give you a smart locked box. But I think clearly they have more in mind and want to be the gateway to your home for a myriad of services. And secondly, his second comment makes me think that I hope Mr. Robot tackles this or a similar system in one of its upcoming plot lines, because he says the first idea to crack the system would be to electronically record the communication signals and then go from there. So, probably one of the first things that will happen once this thing is more publicly available is people will get very busy trying to figure out how to undermine and crack it. So we will be here for that, hopefully, and we'll talk about it when it happens. In the meantime, we're going to move on to our concluding material, and we'll start with our resource of the week. Because it's something for you to look at, but it's also something for us to have a bit of a substantive discussion about, particularly in the week, let us not forget, where we have welcomed the world's first robot citizen, Sophia, the artificially intelligent robot in Saudi Arabia, who is now has her citizenship papers for that country. As Tiffany has been tracking and paying attention to, a number of companies, entities, think tanks, et cetera, have been coming out with their various ethical policies, codes, ways for people to think about ethics when it comes to AI. And the example I put in our discussion points is the Information Technology Industry Council. That's a DC-based group that includes IBM, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple, and others. And they are putting out principles that they hope promotes responsible design and deployment of AI systems, and includes various guidelines and steps for people developing those systems to make sure that they're being responsible. And they're not alone, right, Tiffany? We were talking about how Intel has its own public policy principles for AI. I'm sure others do too. Should we be happy that people are trying to ensure principles and ethics as this technology is being developed?
I think that we should be happy. It's much better than the opposite, right? The total lack of ethical supervision is a problem. We have seen a lot of recent developments in terms of people trying to figure out what AI policy should be. So in addition to this report and the one that you mentioned headed by Intel, the Mercatus Center came out with the AI policy report, I think maybe just last month. And Ryan Kahlo from UWashington also has a paper out right now on policy principles for artificial intelligence. So I think this is definitely something that's getting a lot of traction, and it's not something that we've solved yet, which is why we're getting so many papers all of a sudden just this year, really, about what to do with AI. And it's interesting, again, we talk about the differences between US law and EU law or international law in general, because we have seen specific AI-related legislation in different EU jurisdictions, but we haven't really seen much here in the US. So I think in terms of discussing policy, it's important not just for, you know, the policy makers, but also for advocates, for civil society groups, for academics, for practitioners, and especially practitioners who are in-house, to understand what sort of policy issues might be for AI. Because right now we have the opportunity, which is key. The way linked in this week's resources is really essential for anyone thinking about how to make AI really work in the future or now.
Right. Okay. Thank you for helping us understand what we're seeing and the proliferation of what we're seeing in the way of policies helping to turn AI development in a positive and responsible direction, guide it in that direction. Also, something that you should pay attention to, our tip of the week this week is if you are someone who is inclined to use a DNA testing service such as our sponsor here at the TWiT Network, 23andMe. We've mentioned this before that it, of course, it's always good to read the terms of service before you use any kind of service. Lots of people don't. In this particular arena, the DNA testing arena, we just want to reinforce to you to really delve deep into the terms of service or to read the works of people who have. Kristen V. Brown has a piece at Gizmodo that goes through a number of the terms of service and points out to people that you might not realize. Of course, you realize that you're giving the company the right to test your DNA. That's the only way they're going to be able to tell you anything about the DNA. But the license that you're granting them to do that, it can be broad. It can extend beyond just testing and giving you information. It can enable them to sell your information to make money to other people who want to test your DNA or their huge DNA database that they're developing, and that license might not ever expire unless you decide to specifically get in touch with the company and let them know that. Thank you for the testing, but I'm done now. And the license, you no longer have a license. You can do that, actually, by the way. So if you are somebody who is interested in engaging one of these services, maybe that's something to think about doing. Anyway, our tip of the week is just to, you know, take a pause. Look at those terms of service if you are interested in this, because as this article points out, the business model here is not just to test your results and give you information, but to amass these large databases of this information and do something profitable with it. So you should know what you're in for if your DNA has become part of such a database. Mike or Tiffany, anything you want to add to this?
I think one thing about the DNA databases and the home testing kits, you're not just giving up the rights to your DNA, but because your DNA is inextricably linked to that of all of your family members, you are essentially giving up the privacy rights of your entire family line as well. So something else to keep in mind when you take those home testing kits.
Right, exactly. Mike, any thoughts? Have you done this?
No, I haven't, but Tiffany's reminder is a really good one.
Yeah, I think so too. All right. And then our animal selfie of the week is actually a series of animal selfies by one of our favorite means of taking animal selfies. Many of them were taken by a trap cam. The reason we talk about animal selfies each week, oh, by the way, got to play the bumper. That's one of the reasons we talk about it. So please, Victor, help us out here. Because really, I just love that bumper so much. we talk about it because there has been much debate and head scratching about ownership rights. In fact, there was a whole lawsuit that we referenced earlier in the show about whether an animal can own the copyright to a selfie of itself. Now, our classic animal selfie that we love to feature is the kind that was featured in that lawsuit, where an animal has taken hold of a camera one way or another and shot some pictures of the animal that is holding the camera and potentially the animals around that animal. But the trap camera is a close second, because again, we're into this realm where there is a technology that is operating somewhat independently. It's harkening back to our discussion of creation of CG characters earlier in the show, and creating copyrighted works or copyrightable works, potentially. But no one has actually taken that picture. So does the animal have some interest there? I think most people would say no, but still we find the trap cameras interesting, and they capture some really interesting animal behaviors as more and more of them are out in the world. And this article at The Atlantic features a couple of different examples. One was on Catalina Island, which is about 26 miles dead west of me at the moment, and a fox and a deer, with the deer grooming the fox. That one was taken by what sounds like a naturalist or researcher who was stationed on the island and just happened to spot the two in action and grab his camera and take a picture. But then he was answered by some folks living in the Florida Keys, saying, yeah, your deer grooming the fox is not unusual to us here, because here our deer groom the cats on our island. And so we have some trap camera photos of the cats, and the Atlantic does a nice job of trying to get into the minds of the animals and why we see these interspecies relationships and whether it happens more frequently on islands than it does on a mainland, and otherwise just marveling at the strangeness and cuteness, and speculating that maybe animals are just idiosyncratic like people, and some enjoy interacting with other species and some don't. We just don't know, but there are a series of great photos here. And also gives me the impetus to let you know, since we do feature an animal selfie each week, and we're concerned, of course, with the well-being of all animals that people are taking selfies with. That's the kind of animal selfie that we're a little bit hesitant about. We have featured some where people are taking pictures of themselves with an animal. And of course, there are safe ways to do that, and there are not so safe ways to do that. We discussed a few episodes ago about the tiger selfie phenomenon on Tinder and how dangerous that could be for both the animal and the people involved. So actually, the World Animal Protection Organization has an animal selfie pledge that people can take, a wildlife selfie code that they've put out that gives you some guidelines about taking wildlife selfies. You're pledging not to do it if you take this pledge. If the animal's being held, hugged, or restrained, the animal's being baited with food, or the animal could harm you. But they're promoting wildlife selfies if you're a safe distance away from the animal's in its natural home, and the animal is free to move and not captive. So thank you for the World Animal Protection Agency's looking out for the animals that we love to feature in our Animal Selfie of the Week. And with that, I think we've pretty much wrapped up the show. Tiffany Lee, great to see you again. It's been way too long. We hope to have you on again, maybe probably not before the end of this year, because we're winding down here in 2017, but hopefully not another year before we have you on the show.
Definitely. It's always a fun time. We can talk about maybe by then the AI will have taken over, and that's what we can discuss.
That's right. Maybe by then the AI can tell you whether your animal selfie is safe and protective of animals or not, can curb your behavior in that way. We can
there we go.
maybe taking a pledge doesn't seem like a bad idea for that and various other issues maybe. So it's wonderful to have you on again. And we'd love to hear if there's anything going on at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry or at Yale ISP or the various other entities you're involved with that you want to let people know about before we sign off today.
Well, I would love to direct people to the Yale ISP website to check out our new initiative, which is the Wikimedia and Yale Law School Initiative on Intermediaries and Information. We don't have much on the specific initiative section of the website yet, but in general, there's a lot you can learn about Yale ISP and the really brilliant people that are there. Not including myself, I'm not self-congratulatory, but the other brilliant people who are there and the projects that they're doing, I think really interesting. And if you want, you can follow the Wikimedia Yale Initiative on Twitter. That's Yale ISP underscore WIII. So we tweet news about intermediaries, platforms, all that fun stuff.
That's great. Thank you for cluing us into that. I'm not sure if I'm following you or not, but I will be after the show. That's a great tip. Mike, wonderful to see you again. Mike, I forgot to mention at the top of the show, is a partner at Dorsey & Whitney, if you didn't already know that, in their Seattle, Washington office. Mike, anything you want to let people know about before we get out of here today?
Oh, I don't think so. I think we'll let everybody go, but it was sure great to be with you as always, Denise. And Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting, fascinating discussion.
Yes,
thanks,
it was.
Thanks both of you.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you so much to our audience for being here with us today. We love it when you can join the show live. We record the show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on Fridays. That's when you can head on over to the twit.tv website and watch us live. Or you can, if that doesn't work in your schedule, watch us after the fact in any number of ways. So if you go to twit.tv/twill, you'll find all kinds of guidance on how to enjoy the show on your device of choice, in your context of choice, whether you want to be, you know, on the road, in your car, or in the gym, kicking back on your couch. We're available in all of those formats on various platforms. So however you enjoy the show, we're really pleased if you do come back time and time again. I want to say a special thank you here in the wake of the show's 11th birthday to everyone who's been involved with the show over the years, all of my wonderful co-hosts, all of our amazing, incredible, fabulous guests who come and share their insights with us every week, and everyone at twit.tv who makes this show possible, and of course our wonderful sponsors over the years. It's not been possible, any of it, without all of you, and we're so grateful. It's so fun to do this show. We're just thrilled to be able to come and talk about such interesting issues every single week. So thanks so much, everyone, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.